So I was very tempted to come up onto this seat and give a very brief Dhamma talk, maybe one or two sentences, because we heard the other night in one of Ajahn Amaro's readings about Ajahn Sao. Ajahn Sao was the teacher or mentor for Ajahn Mun. And apparently Ajahn Sao would get up on the high seat and he would deliver a Dhamma talk, maybe of one sentence, such as, being good is good. And then he would get down again. But I have to recognize that I'm not Ajahn Sao. Maybe my sentence would not resonate in quite the same way. And there may be people here expecting perhaps a little bit more than one sentence. So, so tonight is the half moon night. It's the waning moon. And as usual, we gather together to chant, to meditate, to take precepts, and to reflect around certain Dhamma themes. Now, for people who've come from the outside, it may be evident, perhaps not, but that it is evident to us that the Sangha is a little bit thin on the ground, and that is because a fairly important segment of the Sangha is now in Thailand. So it was, I think, only yesterday that Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Ariasilo, most of the Sila Dara departed for Thailand, and there are many, or a number of other monks already out there from Amaravati. The reason is that in Thailand there are going to be a number of important celebrations. This is the 100th anniversary or 100th year since the birth of Ajahn Chah, who was born in June 1918. But the tradition is, or the custom is, to gather at the time of his death day, which was in January, and so that's what people are doing. And so these celebrations will take place over approximately 5 days, beginning on the 12th. And I think the centre of it will be Wat Bapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery. But there is a new feature. They have managed to purchase a plot of land in what was Ajahn Chah's birth village, the village of his birth, a place called Bangor, which is a tiny little village. Now, the house that Lumpo Cha was born in no longer exists, but they, as I say, they bought the plot of land, and on that plot of land they've erected a memorial pillar, what Ajahn Amaro refers to as an Ashokan pillar, to remember Lumpo Cha. And on the 12th they will start by interring relics in or under this pillar. And around the edge of the property, I think, there are a number of other stone reliefs which depict scenes from Lungpo Cha's life. And then they've also rented or purchased some fields nearby the village, or not to one side of the village. And so the main events at Bangor will occur inside those fields. So you can imagine this tiny little village, and something like 40 to 50,000 people will descend upon it for the various events commemorating or remembering Ajahn Chah. And on the 16th, that's the next moon day, we will be remembering Ajahn Chah here in our own way. So anyway, the rest of us are left. We are able to continue with this winter retreat practice, which has been going on already for approximately almost a week. An ideal place, an ideal time in which to cultivate our meditation practice. Now, one significant figure is missing, and that is Ajahn Amaro. He's gone to Thailand and with a group, and of course they'll be away, most of them, for 2 weeks. It's possible that Ajahn Amaro will be away a bit longer, because there is the possibility of a further ceremony, not to do with Lungpo Cha, but to do with scriptures taking place at the Emerald Buddha Temple in Bangkok. So it might be delayed a few more days, and that ceremony might also involve the King of Thailand. So quite an important ceremony if it happens. But one thing is that for some of us here, some members of the community or people who are staying here, it may be that the source of joy or inspiration that they feel in Ajahn Amaro's presence has departed. What galvanizes their practice or gives them happiness is perhaps the sight or the teachings from our senior monk. So this is a very good thing to contemplate, because inspiration has its place. Inspiration is very, very important at different times in our practice. At the very start, obviously, if we don't get some kind of inspiration, we're unlikely to start walking the path. And at other periods, when we get kind of low or stranded or kind of run out of steam, then inspiration can be really helpful to us, to lift us up and to give us a new direction. But the danger, of course, is that we become dependent on inspiration. And if we are just totally dependent on inspiration, what happens when the inspiration goes? So the person goes away, or we have a change of perspective on somebody, or for some reason the inspiration dries up or departs, do we just kind of collapse? So this is something to contemplate and to look at in our own minds and hearts. Of course, Ajahn Amaro is not away for very long, but it's still something to contemplate, isn't it? Do we have the ability to stand on our own two feet, to keep going, to be persistent in the practice without an external figure whom we find inspiring? So can we find that inspiration inside of ourselves? Can we draw on that? Now, as with every winter retreat, we have a very diligent and impressive lay support team, winter support team here, and they're working very hard. I've seen how hard they are working to provide us with the food that we need, but also to keep the monastery clean and comfortable and secure. So that means that monks and nuns and novices, we have far fewer duties than normal. We have this amazing setup where we are given the opportunity basically to practice as much as we want in the course of the day. We don't have to interface with the world. We don't have to respond very much anyway to the needs of people visiting the monastery. We don't have to plug into all the usual demands, computers and phones and so forth. And we have far fewer duties than is normally the case. So this is an ideal situation. And many people, perhaps outside of the monastery, would envy us this opportunity. But nevertheless, in the course of a winter retreat, it goes on for approximately 3 months, there are always some people who find themselves kind of falling apart, if you like, getting depressed or going downhill or not being able to take full advantage of the opportunity. This is a regular part of winter retreats in monasteries. We have to watch out for this. So then how can each one of us put this time to the best possible use? And basically, I think what we need to do, or try to do, is to remember that this religion or practice, this tradition, this teaching is not a question, it's not nothing about blind belief. It is about running throughout this teaching is cause and effect. Cause and effect. So can we, or each one of us, set up the causes, or begin to set up the causes for freedom in our own heart? So how do we go about this if we have this intention? Remembering that this period of time is quite unique in terms of our year, what we do in this period of time will influence our practice for the rest of this year. And the unique nature of this opportunity means that we have the chance to discover things in meditation that we would never normally probably be able to discover if we keep at the practice. So one aspect, or one I think very important aspect to mention, is that of sense restraint. Or in Pali it's Indriya Sangvaro, sense restraint. Because the world is what it is, our sense desire is what it is, we constantly have this tendency to go out looking, following sense desire. It's part of the everyday human makeup, and always has been. But the world we're living in, the era we're living in, has moved into the situation whereby there is a constant bombardment of enticement and allurement and distraction being rained down on people, so that this is you know, just part of everyday life that we're receiving, or people at least in the world are receiving this bombardment of messages trying to encourage them to follow sense desire. If you have to get this product or this particular possibility, then you will be happy. Or to become something. So it's sense desire and becoming, a constant bombardment of messages and images and suggestions to the mind about how, if we go out through the senses, we will be gratified. Now, when we come into the monastery, there's a kind of filter put down on this, so we have much less of it than there is in the world outside. But still, in our everyday activities, there's plenty of opportunity for this outflow through, you know, through the senses, this wanting and desiring and looking and so on and so forth. This is still part of our existence inside the monastery. But when we come into the winter retreat period, then things are much more closed down. People can feel very inhibited or bored or get very fed up and so on, but the point is that we've been offered a very special chance to cultivate sense restraint, because we have to make that more effort to go out to find those sense gratifications that we would normally seek. And you know, the complexity of this world, of the era we're in, is all too evident. So I was, this time last week, I was coming back from Prague in the Czech Republic, and I took a coach from Prague. Ultimately, I was going to London, but it was going to northern Germany. And The first thing that struck me was, as the coach left Prague, everyone was into their phones or their tablets or their laptops. See, it seemed to me, I was just looking around, you know, and then just down the aisle from me, there was a guy who was watching, he was into video games, and he seemed to be watching video games through most of the trip. And then next to me, there was a young Korean lady, a student, over in Europe to learn German, and she spent, it was about an 12-hour trip, and she spent about nearly all her time on the phone, not speaking, but texting or messaging, except when she was asleep or she was eating. So this technology is always encouraging us to try to escape from the here and now. It's about communications and entertainment and distraction. So this is why this opportunity this time is so unique for us, and a unique opportunity. Now the Buddha gave a very, I think very colourful simile about the sense doors. He compared them to six different animals. So the animals he described were a monkey, a bird, a dog, a snake, a hyena, and a crocodile. So these six animals are on leashes. They're all on a leash. But if those leashes are put together and tied together, you've got all six animals tied together with these leashes, and they're all pulling in different directions. So he says the monkey is trying to get up a tree. The bird wants to fly up into the sky. The dog wants to go into the village. The snake wants to head for an anthill. The hyena wants to go to a charnel ground. And the crocodile wants to head for the river. So these animals are pulling each other in different directions, and of course eventually the heaviest, biggest, strongest animal pulls all the others with it. So the crocodile heads for the river and pulls all the other with him, and then drowns them all in the river. But this is what it's like, perhaps, with senses unrestrained. We get overwhelmed in one particular sense gets overwhelmed, all the rest of follow it, and then we somehow get drowned out in whatever we've been attracted to. So this is talking about the value of sense restraint. And there is a sutta called the Sabbasava Sutta, which is about, in English it's called All the Taints, and it talks about various ways in which taints can be eradicated, or kilesas, defilements, can be eradicated. And one of these ways is through being restrained. So it talks about restraint of the various sense faculties. So it says, taints, vexation, and fever do not arise in one who has the eye faculty restrained. Taints, vexation, and fever do not arise in one who has the eye faculty restrained. And so too with the other faculties, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. Well, Ajahn Chah uses, with his very homely similes, he uses a simile about a leaf. He says, the mind is like a leaf. It's fluttering or trembling in the wind. And how it flutters and how it trembles depends upon the nature of the sense impression. He says that for one who knows little Dhamma, or if one knows only a little Dhamma, then the tendency of the mind is to continuously follow mental impressions. And he also talks about the mind as being like a child without a mother or a father. So it's like an orphan, if you like. And this child really needs someone to care for it. And who can care for your mind if not you? So just if you see a child heading to do something unwise, like heading to a hot stove to touch it, or some other dangerous substance or whatever, then you will try to stop the child doing that. You will naturally try to restrain the child. But what about your own mind? Are you ready to restrain your own mind? So to go back to the Sabhasava Sutta for a moment, it talks about taints that can be eradicated through restraining. I just talked about restraining the sense faculties. But also, there are other taints that can be eradicated through, it says, through seeing. And what it's talking about is, it says the untaught, ordinary, worldly person attends to things, sees things, pays attention to things that result in the increase of sense desire, becoming, and ignorance. So the ordinary worldly person pays attention, this results in the increase of sense desire, becoming, and ignorance. Not only that, but also they attend to views about the self. So we can think about the narrative about me, my past, my future, what kind of person I am, my problems, my faults, and all the rest of it. Or we can get into comparing. So this is all views about the self. But the sutta suggests that the well-taught noble disciple does not pay attention to things which result in an increase in sense desire, becoming, and ignorance. Nor does he or she pay attention to views about the self. He or she understands the danger in these things. So the question arises, what kinds of things are fit for attention? What can we pay attention to if we follow this kind of advice? And the answer comes back to the Four Noble Truths. So using this as a constant contemplation. So it's an everyday contemplation to be used all through the day. It's not a philosophical position, as you know, probably, but something to be used as a contemplative tool. So suffering, you know, where's the suffering? Or what is the suffering right now? What is the cause of the suffering? The cessation of suffering, and then the practice path leading to the end of suffering. So constantly calling on the Four Noble Truths. So this can sound perhaps a bit dry, but if we start to internalize this and actually use it, it can be a great, you know, this is the primary tool of this practice, is looking at suffering, its cause, its ending, and how to bring it to an end. Or with his homely similes, Ajahn Chah talks about happiness and unhappiness. Pleasure and pain. So he talks about happiness and unhappiness. Neither state, he says, is peaceful. Why is that? Why is neither state peaceful? Because both states are bound up with wanting. If we are unhappy, We want to get away from that unhappiness. We want that unhappiness to leave us. We seek out pleasure. We want to distract, or we seek out some kind of happiness. But even when we're happy, we're still bound up with wanting because we don't want it to go. And if we're having a great time, wonderful person, wonderful experience, we don't want this to end. And yet, it will end. Inevitably, the experience will come to an end. We can't prolong it forever. We might try, but it will come to an end. So he compares the happiness-unhappiness duality to a snake. He says, if we, you know, you have the head of the snake and the tail of the snake, if you reach for the head of the snake, which is unhappiness, then of course you've got these poisonous fangs and you'll get a very vicious bite or even a deadly bite from the head. But if you reach for the happiness end, which is the tail, if you reach for the tail, initially you might be okay, might be fine. But eventually the snake will turn back and it will bite you anyway, because of course, of the impermanent nature of these experiences. So he's pointing to this constant unsatisfactoriness of living in this vortex of happiness and unhappiness. Well, Ajahn Amaro's take on this is, well, there are two kinds of happiness. One is getting what you like, trying to get what you like, and the other is liking what you get. And the second one is, of course, a lot more realistic, liking what you get. Initially, the experiences we have to go through, the contacts we have, may appear to be not of our choosing, not what we want. The me inside me doesn't want that particular experience. But that's the challenge, isn't it? Facing up to what we don't want. So it's somebody from somebody who's not particularly well versed in the Buddhist teachings might say, well, what a miserable religion! It teaches you can't be happy or you shouldn't be happy, and so on and so forth. But of course, there is happiness and pleasure in the practice. So we talk about two kinds of happiness, really: the worldly happiness, which I've just been talking about, and Lungpo Cha refers to in the simile of the snake, or the other kind of happiness, which is the joy or the pleasure we can get from the practice, from cultivating the path. So if we apply ourselves to anapanasati, to watching the breath, we can get a lot of, it becomes a source of pleasure. We can enjoy it. And this is a legitimate kind of pleasure, or a harmless kind of pleasure. If we review the parts of the body, if we start to let go of unskillful mind states, we can experience a pleasure, and this is a harmless kind of pleasure. So this kind of pleasure is what's encouraged in terms of cultivating the path. But we also have to remember that our natural inclination is to, out of our instinctual urges, out of our mind state, our tricky mind, if you like, is to pursue pleasure and to escape from pain. We're constantly trying to get away from that which we dislike. whether it's perhaps a situation we don't like, we want to avoid a situation, or whether it's perhaps a physical pain or discomfort or something we don't want to go through, or whether it's certain mind states. There are certain mind states we do not wish to experience, or moods or emotions that bring up a lot of aversion. We don't like them. And perhaps, you know, in terms of our practice in the course of these few months, this is one area where we can learn to be perhaps a bit inventive or a bit creative. So if you fear, if you loathe or fear the cold, you could try taking a cold shower before you know, starting the day with a cold shower. This is what Ajahn Sumedho used to do. He arrived from Thailand in 1977. He was living in this place in Haverstock Hill. The monks were quite depressed because they had to leave the forest and had to leave, of course, a nice warm climate. And they were stuck in the winter in England, not knowing what was going to happen. And he felt depressed. He didn't like the cold at all. But the way he tackled that problem was he would start the day with a cold shower and then stand on his head for half an hour. And it worked. Or if perhaps you experience a lot of sense desire, you know, sensual desire, then if this becomes a constant theme, then this is an opportunity to start experimenting with asubha practices. You know, this stripping down the body, looking at the different parts, looking at all the less pleasant aspects of the body. Easy enough, particularly if you consider your own body. Starting with your own body, I find easier. And if you start examining closely, sooner or later you start to see the less pleasant aspects of body. It's not so difficult. So maybe we have to get, you know, we have to really wake up to what's going on with us. This is, I think, the crucial aspect. We have to be as honest as we can be about where it is our mind gets caught, where it is it gets snagged. This is perhaps the most difficult thing, isn't it? Being honest about what's going on. Because again and again we have the tendency to fool ourselves, to follow the line of least resistance, to do that which is the easiest thing to do. So that's why we have to come up with some challenges, make some aditana, some resolutions. If we don't like getting up in the morning, well, we make ourselves get up a bit earlier. If we suffer from dullness and drowsiness, we set ourselves certain regimes whereby we have to stay awake. But every one of us has to come up with our own set of practices or trainings, because we're all different. What is easy for one person is difficult for another. So, as all the teachers suggest, the only way to the end of suffering is by experiencing suffering, by embracing suffering, by opening up to the suffering. If we're constantly running away from the suffering, we don't make the progress. We just don't cultivate the path. Well, we do, but not in a very effective way. So we have to be open to embracing the suffering. So Ajahn Chah's saying was, if you don't see suffering, if you don't see suffering, you'll have to go on suffering. Or as Prat Payuttam has put it, if it's not just a question of seeing dukkha. Obviously, we have to see the dukkha. But it's looking also at the causes of dukkha. So we have to look at the causes of dukkha and let go of them. And this is why what's recommended is this attention called yoniso manasikara, wise attention, systematic or careful attention, yoniso manasikara. The Buddha said that yoniso manasikara is the forerunner of the seven factors of enlightenment. Yoniso manasikara creates the space in which wisdom can arise. So what do we mean by yoniso manasikara? Well, the opposite of yoniso manasikara is ayoniso manasikara, which is unwise attention or unsystematic attention. This is the everyday way we attend to the world. And when we are caught in ayoniso manasikara, we see permanence in the impermanent. We see beauty in the foul. We see pleasure in pain, in the painful. And we see self in the not-self. And yoniso manasikara is the opposite of all of that. Coming to see that which is impermanent as impermanent, and so on and so forth. So it's like what we're looking at is the vipalasa, or what they call cognitive distortions. We see things in a certain way, coming from our own desire. But the cognitions that we have arise out of our mental habits. And cognition can be retrained. We can learn to see things in a slightly different way, if we apply this right kind of attention. So it means examining closely what's going on and how we're perceiving things and how we're reacting to things. So as I was talking about being inventive and creative, or bringing in some kind of ingenuity into the practice as a way of maintaining interest and also of challenging these difficult aspects of our practice. And the two inspiring stories that I came across concerned Ajahn Lee Damodaro, who's another great teacher in the forest tradition, and who came up with some very original ways of going about things. Now, I don't think we can all come up with quite what he came up with, but it's interesting to know or to remember what it was he came up with. So, for example, in the 1940s, he went to visit India. He was in India, already a young monk, and he came across all these yogis in India who were using beds of nails, who were standing on one leg all day, and so on and so forth. And he was rather impressed with this. And the question in his mind was, what are they doing, or how is it they're enabled to do this? But he never went to any of the yogis to ask them. He decided to sit in meditation, in concentration, and just to feed in the question into his own mind. What is it they're doing? How is it they do this, to undertake these practices? So he came up with his own answer, and the answer was, they are playing with the breath energies in the body. So that's how he began to develop his own practice with regard to breath energies in the body. This was his understanding of the situation. And later in life, several years later, he decided to spend the rains retreat in a far distant place in northern Thailand. He had to trek through the forest, through the jungle for 3 days to get to this place. Completely far away from any center or what we would call civilization. He got to the place, and then within a day or two he had a heart attack. So there he was, there was no doctor, no hospital, no help, just this sort of very primitive place and the bare necessities. So what was he to do? So that's where he used his ingenuity, and he started to use this practice of the breath energies, particularly in the body, to try to explore the heart condition that he had, breathing into certain parts of the body, relieving tension and tightness and so forth. And he was able to do this for the 3 months, and by the end of that time he was a lot better. And he was able to walk out through that jungle again, even though he'd had a heart attack in the place where he'd been living. So this is a kind of inspiring example of using the situation, using what's actually happening to us as a basis for some kind of ingenuity in the practice, experimenting with things. We should not be afraid in the course of this winter retreat to experiment with things that we think might be of use to us. So if we take this line of action, if we pursue the course, pursue the practice with sincerity and earnestness, bring our energies to bear on it, don't give up, don't waste our time getting lost in unwise preoccupations, then I think we can say to ourselves, yes, I haven't made the mistake of grabbing onto the tail of the snake. And yes, I have begun to set up causes for freedom of the heart. And the Buddha's injunction was, as you probably know, do not waste time, monks. There are the roots of trees, there are huts, there are caves. Do not waste time. Life is short. Life is transient. So I'd like to offer these thoughts for your contemplation. If anything I have said is wrong or a mistake, please forgive me. And please only take away that which is of use to you. Ewan.